I used to give no worries about things I couldn't see. I used to have no problems with anyone but me. But now when I lay my head down, I can think of other things that I chose not to see. And I can't breathe. And I can't breathe. And I can't breathe. And I can't breathe. I used to have small heartaches that I could ignore. I've never felt my skin in such a way before.
Welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I am your host, Leslie Mack. This actually is a very special episode of the Ferguson Response Network. I actually was sick last week, and my wonderful co-host, Ricky Hines II, stepped in and led a really powerful discussion on the sociology of white supremacy. So we have Ricky coming up, and if you didn't know, Ricky's a Los Angeles native, U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger, founder of the Americans United Again movement, and host of two other podcasts, the Americans United Again podcast, and also he co-hosts the AUA Hope podcast with the lovely Sherelle. He has three guests on with him, John Pennyman and Molly, both from the Pennyman Doctrine, and also Tim Druck, who is our token white guy, who's going to come and talk about the sociology of white supremacy. If this is your first time listening to us, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Ferguson Response. And you can also find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. And if you have actions coming up in your area or are hoping or looking for actions coming up in your area, you can go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. Due to the nature of the specific topic today, I actually changed up the song at the beginning, which is written and performed by Dave Connes, and it's called I Can't Breathe, a song for Eric. Dave is a white guy who was really moved by Eric Garner's story and wanted to put his thoughts down. I think it speaks a lot to supremacy and privilege about Dave's specific connection to this enlightenment that he's had on the account of recent events. And I will have the link to that in the show notes. We'll go ahead and skip the usual news portion of the show because Ricky led a really healthy and robust discussion. And so we're going to head right into the segment and I'll turn it over to Ricky. He's discussing again the sociology of white supremacy. Thanks for joining us for the Ferguson Response Network podcast.
All right, everyone. Welcome to the main part of the discussion for this episode. And this is going to be the sociology of white supremacy and how that relates to the country on a macro level and then on a micro level. And I actually have guest hosts with me today because Leslie was unable to do the show today. She's not feeling all that well. Hope you get better, Leslie. So, as substitute hosts, I have John Pennyman, who's been on the show before, and Molly, who is the president of the Pennyman Doctrine podcast. So, welcome you guys.
Hey, what's going on, everybody?
Thank you for having us.
And you can find them at thepennymandoctrine.com. Is that correct?
Thepennymandoctrine.blogspot.com.
That's right. I always screw that up. My apologies.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, we have a guest on. His name is Tim Druck. And Tim has served aboard the United States Warship Enterprise as a nuclear propulsion operator. He's a bass guitarist in Lame, a heavy rock trio from his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. He's a writer and podcast contributor for OnyxTruth.com and Urban X and Industrial Decay photographer. He's also pretty fly for a token white guy. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, man. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. So I wanted to play in a clip before we jump right into this, and this clip is from Professor Eddie Gloud, who is the head of African American Studies at Princeton. He's also an author and really amazing at breaking down the concept of white supremacy as a practice within the United States. And so we're just going to play a clip of how he explains basically how it works on a macro level with a really good example that I've tried to use before, but I can't quite put it like he does. We actually tried to have him on the show, but he was apparently a little busy, and you know, I'm a nobody, so he'll. Here's the clip.
It's hard for people to hear the phrase white supremacy and not think of people running around in hoods, white hoods, and burning crosses in yards, or you know. Putting up Nazi, you know, swastikas or the like. But white supremacy is really about the belief and the practice that white people ought to be valued more than non-white people. And we tend to think about that as holding a racist belief when in fact it can be evidenced in the very social arrangements that organize our lives. So who has access to the best schools? Who has access to inherited wealth? Who has access to the best jobs? Who has, we have to understand as well, Brother Sam, is that white supremacy is not just simply the ideology of white people, right? It's a practice that I can participate in. That President Obama can be the head of, you know, can participate in. And so part of, you know, and in the background that's in my head is, you know, this wonderful moment in James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time where he says, as long as we've been, I'm paraphrasing here, as long as we believe we're a white nation in the vein of Europe, we will never achieve our country. And so part of the challenge is that, you know, I mean, just to really quickly, another study says that, you know, people believe that, you know, racial equality is a zero-sum game, that as black folk gain more access to American life, many white respondents believe that they lose, right, benefits and resources. So when you have this view of racial equality as a zero-sum game, then we understand what the stakes are. Right? We understand what the stakes are. And now we have this wonderful, wonderfully efficient ideological frame to blame the very people who are locked out and marginalized for their own marginalization, right? So, you know, let's make Michael Brown a thug. Let's make him a criminal. Let's give an account of the culture of poverty that has produced these people who don't warrant the kind of respect and dignity that we would accord to others. If that makes sense to you.
Yes, I mean,
So what are everyone's thoughts as far as how that applies to the overall structure of white supremacy?
Who wants to take that one first?
I mean, I'd go ahead. He makes a very convincing argument, and he kind of breaks it down in a way that makes it a lot easier for people to understand. I know personally within conversations that I have with, people that either just want to argue with me or even people that say they want to help or want to be an ally, as soon as you bring up the word white supremacy, they automatically say, I'm not KKK, and that's not what it is. White supremacists is a part of white supremacy.
They're the fan club, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So a white supremacist believes that the white people are better and deserve this and that, and, you know, blacks and Jews and other Christian, you know, sects shouldn't be able to be participate in the culture. And white supremacy is the actual you know, carrying out of what the KKK wants. And it's funny because, you know, as much as we want to bash and talk down at, and rightfully so, the KKK, we don't even pay attention to our local government, which actually is doing what the KKK wants. We don't look at our federal government. We don't look at our police institutions. We don't look at our military. We don't look at the way business is structured. We don't look at, you know, the way housing developments are structured. We don't look at the way we are able to get food. We don't look at all the other different processes that exist that create the dominant culture in society that is the United States of America. And we don't even equate that to white supremacy, as it is so, is so blatantly obvious if you look at statistics on jobs and statistics on crime rates and statistics on arrest rates. And this, and, you know, something that this program is about is, you know, the Ferguson Response Network, the statistics on, you know, how police react to black faces. It's not even lives. It's not even, you know, actions. It's their face. Oh,
he scared me. He looked like a Hulk. I needed to shoot him.
You know,
it looks like target practice.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's, white supremacy is the system of what our society is that we are slowly trying to break apart. And that's why it's so hard for people to kind of understand it, because, you know, when I say the statistic, people don't believe me. There's over 200 million white people in this country. Over 200 million. No one else compares. And it's funny, you know, that statistic about, you know, if you were,
well, you know, by 2030, you know, white people are going to be a minority.
If you combine all the other races combined, motherfucker, like, it doesn't even work like that. Right. You are the majority, period. There is no physical way, unless all of us start impregnating everybody, that you are going to be a minority. So based off of just your pure numbers, why can't you understand that the government, this country, the laws, the businesses, the jobs, the police departments were built for and by you. And if we are going to go into a post-racial anything, you need to acknowledge that and allow all these other subsects, cultures, and lives to matter into the things that need to be factored in.
Well, I think I kind of, I mean, it's interesting because if you look at it, it's white supremacy is basically not having the conversation that needs to be had. You know, our young kids, if you show them a black baby doll and a white baby doll, even a lot of the black kids will choose that the white baby doll is the pretty one, you know, because that's what they see. That's what they see on TV. You know, we're ingrained to see, I mean, the Constitution was of a bunch of white men. I mean, we were built off of white supremacy, and it's like a slow bleed. And unless someone tries to stop it, it's going to continue to be a huge issue. And like what John said, it's not about KKK leaders or people standing on the streets saying that white is the best. But I mean, people, you know, the big hair debate, you know, having long, silky, flowing hair is like the only hair that you're supposed to have. Or, you know, that if you don't speak perfectly without, you know, any flaw, then you're not smart. You know, like the one girl that recently had the thing about why I talk like I'm white. Did you see that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it needs to be discussed, because it is ingrained in every single person, whether we want to face it or not. That's, yeah.
Yeah. You know, just right off the bat, the first thing that I want to say is that I kind of have a and I don't mean to pick on John here, but I have a problem with the term post-racial. I think that a lot of what causes a white supremacist attitude, and I don't like the term white supremacy either. I'm going to get to that in just a second. Is the fact that that people are afraid of their culture being assimilated. You know, you hear, you know, white folks all the time in a less hateful manner talk about their pride in being Irish Americans or in being, English Americans or being German Americans or things like that. And they preserve, you know, portions of their culture. And I think that part of white supremacy is that we don't value African American culture and African culture in the same way that we value the German American culture and the Irish American culture and things absolutely. Like that. And we feel like, you know, and I'm not, you know, I'm going to exempt myself here because even though I am white, I don't feel this way, but I'll say white, you know, I'll say we, because that's just the best way to
the
say it.
The overwhelming feeling.
Yeah. The overwhelming feeling is that if we allow, you know, black folks to, you know, that, you know, our culture will meld and assimilate and disappear. And I think that maybe black folks have a little bit of that fear too. It definitely should. Because a lot of the answer of white supremacists as to why you can't get ahead is, well, you don't act white enough, basically. I mean, that's not how they say it, but that's what they're saying is, well, when you talk like white people and act like white people, and test scores like white people and this like that, then maybe you'll get what you're looking for. And, you know, so the problem, instead of respecting each other's cultures, a lot of what's going on is a fear of assimilation from your culture and a fear of the disappearing of both cultures. You know, so instead of saying post-racial, maybe we should, I don't want to get past, you know, I don't want to get past a racial culture as much as I think we should respect each other's racial cultures and see the value of each other's cultures. You know, when I think of black folks, I don't think of, you know, and I'm going to point out some stereotypes here. I don't think of criminals and thugs and things like that. I respect, you know, I think of, I'm standing at my stove right now making red beans and rice. You know, I think of great musicians and of, you know, people who've contributed to our society that, you know, entirely, sometimes because of black culture, you know, sometimes people talk about like, you know, it might be a stereotype say, hey man, black people can cook, but man, black ethnic food is some pretty good stuff, you know, and
it's made from the worst of ingredients, to be quite honest. I mean, it's made from the shit that you weren't even supposed to eat.
That's what I'm saying. And the talent, talent of these amazing people to come up with these things that were, you know, this amazing food out of what other people didn't want. Man, why can't we celebrate that as a matter of ingenuity and of resourcefulness, man? The black people that I know are creative and resourceful and, you know, they have to work harder than the white people I know just to get the same things, you know, and that's where I grew up. And that's why, you know, I don't want to be post-racial. I want to celebrate, you know, culture. And I think that's an attitude that we have to teach our children or it's never going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, another thing, you know, I talked about not liking the term white supremacy. I really think, and I can't think of a word that's like the opposite of supremacy, but it's like black, the opposite of supremacy. You know, white people don't really want to, at least in my observation, it's not that they want to be better, it's that they want to hold black people down. So when you say white supremacy, you're talking about, you know, putting white people on a pedestal when really what they're trying to do is keep black people in the ditch. And that's not white supremacy. That's stomping on black folks. I really think that we have to look at it in terms of what we're doing, not some sort of notional thing that we're trying to accomplish. As far as and getting back to the original audio clip, man, I think the good doctor is right on. I think that the things that he said about the way that society is structured to benefit white people and to benefit and to prevent access to the things that get us ahead in culture, that get all of us ahead in culture if you have access to them, we find ways to restrict that to whites and sometimes even to white males, you know, to get it even, you know, to make it even more specific. And I'm sure we'll go into that farther in the show, but I think the doctor is right on. I think he said it in a very eloquent way. And I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss it because it's the truth. And if you don't see it, then you're just not paying attention.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, I think that it's a matter of, this is something that Tim kind of touched on, that he said, and it's as long as we believe that we are a country in the vein of Europe, we will never reach our potential. And the reason why that's a problem, and the reason why that's right is because we have so many cultures. The American culture has always been a melting pot, whether it be, you know, the Spanish, the African slaves who were brought here, the Germans, the Jewish. We've always just brought everyone together, and until we start including, or until we start seeing ourselves as a country that's also in the vein of Africa, that's also in the vein of Latin America, that's also in the vein of the indigenous people here, that's also in the vein of Asia, we will never reach our full potential.
But that to me, Ricky, is the hard part, because I love history. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned that on all the different shows that I've been on with you, but I love history a lot. And it's funny though, you know, one of my favorite history podcasts to listen to is Hardcore History with Dan Carlin. And whenever because he has 4-hour long podcasts, so you gotta get into a place where you can zone in and zone out, you know what I mean? And just let the way he tells the historical story just ride, and it, you know, you feel like you're there almost. But when I do that, and he's talked about World War I was his most recent history series. And he's talked about World War II. That's what I remember listening, starting on with him back in a couple years ago. But, you know, I don't picture the African and the native and the Latino and the Hispanic and all the different melting pots. I see white people when I hear that stuff. I think of the atrocities that have happened. I think of white people when I think of American history. Well, I mean, I don't think of white people as in like the different intricacies of the history, but I'm talking about American history as a whole. I think of the atrocities that white people have done. And to me, that's the part of white supremacy that, you know, I understand that you don't like that term, Tim, and I, you know, I can definitely understand that. But,
no, we don't have a better term for it right now. But
yeah,
I mean,
exactly. For lack of a better term.
But it is what it is.
It's about as accurate as a term as you could really expect at you know, really diagnosing something like that. But
sure. The thing about it is when you have that and you know, you have no better term based off of what has been done. And then you have situations where, in Arizona, where you can't have ethnic studies because it's going to rile them up. It's going to make them angry. It teaches anti-American sentiment. No, bitch, that's your history. That's right. What the people in your positions before did to people in the positions in our position before.
They killed them. Here's the thing. I think it also comes with a lot of reckoning. Having to, in order to see yourself as a country in the vein of not just Europe, but Africa, Asia, Central America, Latin America, you have to be able to reckon with the things that you've done to those people. You have to, it's like, in order, and it's basically, for lack of a better way to put this, it's almost the being accepted into whiteness. Because whiteness and white privilege isn't really a privilege. It's just what every person should have. Like every, you know, it's being able to be looked at as an individual, being seen as, you know, a group collective, or being seen as a good person. The only thing that makes it a privilege is that it's not afforded to everyone else. And that's where I don't understand the thought or the pathology that this is a zero sum game, because no one wants to take white privilege away from white people. We just want it. We just want to have it for ourselves as black people. We want Native Americans to be able to have it. We want Latinos to be able to have it. This is, you know, we want Asian Americans to be able to have it. It's not, it's what everyone should have. And guess what? When it becomes what everyone should have, we're not even going to call it white privilege anymore. No one had, no, because it'll be
life.
The standard,
it'll be
life. We just want life. Like, you have life. That's it. I don't understand
You made mention to, you know, as soon as America can get out of the idea of being in, you know, a vein of Europe, they'll be able to do that. We would be able to be, you know, a better country and whatnot. Well, you know, not to get too deep, but let's look at the European mindset throughout, I guess, a couple millennia in history. Well, I mean, because that's as far back as we can go, because they don't have any relevant history before that. You see what I'm saying? So they, if you know anything about the history of, you know, I guess the modern world, you got these bottom feeding, and I'm not trying to say this in a demeaning way. That's just what it was. These bottom feeding, non-agricultural, figuring out, no naval experience, don't know how to build ships, you know, just living in their own filth type people, living in a, what we call the dark ages, because it was a dark age, had no ability to do anything except, you know that some arbitrary man was a king and, you know, you're supposed to lick his balls. Through going out and finding out that there were other cultures, and these other cultures are able to do this and that, and they learned and they this, and they were able to become what is what we have today, in modern day. The thing about that is this micro point goes into the macro point as well. And I think I've said this to you before or in another program, but, the white people as an institution's biggest fear is that if they give up the quote unquote supremacy or power that they have now, that these other groups, the blacks, the Hispanics, the natives, the whatever, are going to do to them what they have done to us for the past almost 1,000 years.
Right. But even again, that goes back to the irrationality of it, because you are by and far the physical majority in this country, not only from a policy standpoint, because that never happen, but it could also never happen from if white people now decided they were going to ethnically cleanse the United States, there's nothing really stopping them. Like, can we be honest about this? I mean, it's not like they're not the majority still, you know, and even when they are no longer the majority, nobody wants this shit. We understand how that feels. We don't wish that on anybody.
But that also goes into the perception that, again, you know, the point that I made, that when I tell especially white people that there's 200 million white people in this country, they lose their fucking mind because they don't believe me. They're like,
there's not that many.
Yes, there are that many of you.
It's math.
That's the same kind of shit where people, you know, they fudge budget numbers to make their arguments too, man. And it's the same people. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to categorize. We all know who it is. Yeah. Anyway, you know, I'm gonna point this at a big problem. You know, and this is some. Maybe it's because we've never been downtrodden, but I mean, white people have an alarming empathy problem, and that is a historical fact.
Yeah.
And that's something I know we had a discussion, and I don't want to go into it here with a couple of what's the politically correct term for mixed these days? you know, and the thing that alarmed me about those two guys was that the alarming lack of empathy that they have for what should be part of their community, to not even see black folks as a part of their community. You know, and I only know my own experience here, man. I grew up, you know, next door to a black family and across the street from a black family, and I watched their dads and moms go to work every day and have to work, you know, as hard or harder than my dad to have the same things. And I saw them, you know, pay their bills and raise their children and do things just like us. And no amount of racism in the world could have taken that experience out of me, that those people were my friends and neighbors and that I should care about their welfare the same way that they, you know, that they care about and that I care about my people.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, what I don't understand about racism in general is the lack of empathy, that people don't see those people as part of their community. And we've done some very irrational things. We being white people, I hate to include myself in white people sometimes. And that's, man, that's some self-loathing that maybe only black people can understand. Yeah. I look back through history and I see how white people have done some really cruel shit, man, to maintain the the macro thing that we're talking about. You know, white people have done some really cruel shit to each other and to other people. Man, white people invented the guillotine and white people invented the rack and white people invented the Iron Maiden and white people were the ones who, you know, it wasn't, you know, and people, you know, one of the things that white apologists like to talk about is that there's always been slavery in the world. Well, man, I've been through some history in my life, and I'll tell you that there rarely, if ever, was as brutal an enslavement as in the American South.
Absolutely.
You know, Africans and African enslavement was, you know, them people had families and jobs and time off, and they could earn a little money and buy themselves out of slavery eventually. I'm not justifying slavery here, but that's nowhere near as brutal as having an entire region of a country where the churches taught that black people were accursed people and they deserved their slavery. Yeah. I mean, you know, and this is the thing.
But like when you talk about, when they even talk about, you know, oh, well, the transatlantic slave trade ended in the early 1800s. Yeah, but do you understand why that happened? And it's the reason is that there were enough black people here that you could basically just breed them.
Just breed slaves. That's
breed
why it happened.
Slaves, and you could make money. Slavery was such an integral part of this country's economy that when people, when black people talk about reparations, it's for a really good reason. I'm not making this shit up. Like when you serve as property, that means you no longer, you don't have your legal rights.
You don't have any
as
rights.
As a human being. Yeah. Your property. So that means that you can be traded on. You can be traded. You can have loans taken out on you. You can be insured.
You're collateral, man. You're not even chattel, man. You're property. And this is something, and this is, you know, another, you know, indication of the macro part of the institutionalization of racism is that we don't teach that, man. Every time we take away an AP history class, like they're going to Oklahoma, they're talking about taking away AP history. Yeah. Every time we rewrite the history books to say the triangle trade instead of the slave trade, every time we whitewash our history, we take away the motivation to disgust our children with our past behavior so that they never do it again. I was 21 years old before I knew this is a disgusting fact. I was 21 years old before I knew that so many slave bodies had been thrown off of ships in the Atlantic Ocean when they died on the ships, that the sharks in the Atlantic Ocean changed their migrating patterns because of the plentiful food. That's crazy, man. That's crazy. And people should know that because it should disgust you. It should make you feel like the foulest person in the world when you find that out. I learned more about slavery from Chuck D than I ever did in school. And that's a damn shame. And that's one way that white people, when you don't have to be a hood wearing KKK member to keep black people in their place. And it's one way white people do it is they don't educate their own children about the disgusting things that we did. And that's a mission in my life, man. I got a seventh grade daughter, man, and they don't teach history in school anymore, but I want my daughter to understand what happened in Rosewood. I want my daughter to know who Megger Evers was. I want my daughter to know what happened to Emmett Till, and I want her to be violated by it. I want her to feel the utmost revulsion for those things. And I think those are things that we have to teach, man. We have to teach why we should never do this to people again.
Yeah.
And education is the biggest way that we prevent the elimination. Education is the way you get rid of ignorance. And racism is ignorance. It's taught. It's not, you're not born with it. We all know that. You're taught that at home. And education is the only way to change the attitudes of people. And all the laws in the world, all the changing of social structures and the access and the affirmative action and the welfare and all the things we want to talk about, none of them are going to be entirely effective in eradicating racism because a law cannot change a man's heart. Only Absolutely. Knowledge can do that. Only the truth can do that. And as long as we are lying to our children about the things we've done in the past, then we're never going to change our future.
You yeah. couldn't be more correct on that. Cause I mean,
get him,
I know.
Molly. Get him. Sorry.
I've had so many conversations with, you know, my white friends. I've attempted it with my family, but it tends to not go well. I don't know if you know Tim, but I'm adopted into, I was raised in a very white atmosphere.
Okay,
and
no,
somehow or another, I got on my own little path and I was able to navigate myself in my own way, which I'm very proud of. But, I can tell you that the one thing that's very difficult, the one thing that's very, very difficult with, you know, that group of people in general is the conversation. And they don't want to teach that as an education because even though, you know, they'll say like how Richard said on that, you know, the Onyx Truth podcast,
mm-hmm.
how he said that,
fuck
oh my
that
gosh,
guy, by the way. I'm sorry. Hold on.
Yeah.
Can I just say this before you continue, Molly?
Yeah, Richard go ahead
Miles,
because I just lost my thought.
Oh, sure thing. Richard Miles, sincerely, deep down, from the bottom of my heart, I have a lot of sympathy for you because I feel sorry for you. And it almost pains me to say, no, it doesn't pain me. Fuck you, sir. That's all.
Yeah, basically.
And it's been that kind of week for me. So, and I apologize to the listeners, but that had to be said, period.
Yeah, he can kiss Molly. My white naked ass.
Oh. All right,
so Molly, where were you going?
He's a mess. But the education is a very, very difficult part. And just like he tried to say to you, you know, have you experienced the pain that your family went through? And the part that I made the thing about, the meme about. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. What did he say right there?
That I hadn't suffered basically from institutionalized racism.
Yes.
That
yes.
For example, the pain that my grandmother went through living in the Deep South, being lighter skinned, and also being the daughter of a preacher, and then later on in her life having some issues as well. Like, you don't think that that pain translates into her children? You don't think that that pain translates into her grandchildren? The things that people who deal with those kinds of things do just to deal with life, a lot of the times it's just fucked up, you know?
And
they'll put up with things that they won't put up with, that they shouldn't put up with in other regions. And then it has a negative effect on their children and their grandchildren. And it's yes, I've suffered.
And that is the argument, though. Like, that is a very traditional white argument. Like, they don't want to teach that education because they don't want to admit that that stuff actually pains. Like, those are the pains that the black culture is experiencing as we speak. Like, no. It's not the same. I know what lynching is, by the way. I want to make that point very clear. You know, no, we don't see lynching on a day-to-day basis, but metaphorically, lynching still exists. The mentality still exists. And if education could be provided in schools, if it could be a conversation that is openly had at the dinner table right along with religion, me and John are big on that for sure, you know, then things would get better. But it's so much easier, you know, and I say this, and it goes both ways. It can be either one. But I don't necessarily think that every white person is racist when they don't want to admit to this argument. But what I can say is that so many white people just are not willing and blind. So many of them are so blind that they just want to continue believing that this is no longer an issue because their mind, it should be swept under the rug and it should just be everyone should get along, but that's where the, you know, good old white supremacy sneaks its ugly face in. And we have to realize that it is still very much an issue. And education is huge. I mean, education is huge on every level. Sex education, we wouldn't have half the pregnancies and diseases in the world. Race, you know, race education, we wouldn't have half of the shit going on if people could just be fucking honest. Are we allowed to be cussing this much?
Oh, of course.
Okay. You know, if people could just be open and honest, because that's where it all starts, but that tends to be the hardest thing is just to sit down and admit it. And I've said this a million times, but so many people, they don't understand their privilege, but they're willing to admit it on a daily basis, and they don't even realize they're admitting it. Ever.
I don't know if it's bad form or not to plug your own article, but I wrote on a similar subject. You know, I think some people, one of the reasons that people don't want education, particularly about racial relations in school, is because they're ashamed of it. The people who are aware of it are ashamed of it, and they don't want to talk about it. And that's kind of a positive thing. But you have to get past your shame so that you can educate your children so that they're not ashamed of it.
Exactly.
And another reason that people don't want to talk about racism and they don't understand their own racism and they don't understand white privilege in particular is that a lot of it is unconscious. It's social conditioning. The way that you would never use the N-word. You would never say something demeaning or derogatory about a black person, but your brain is telling you at 2 o'clock in the morning when a black person comes up behind you at the ATM, you get that little ball of ice in your stomach.
Right.
You don't want to be a racist, but your social conditioning has caused that. I actually wrote an article on Onyx Truth called Blurred Lines about this. I want to read the first few lines of it because it kind of explains my argument better. I took the time to write it and better than I could do it off the cuff.
Sure.
It's all about lines. It's about the difference between wanting to be right and being right. It's about where your comfort level ends and your fears begin. It's about social conditioning. It's about sometimes you shock yourself with the things you don't say out loud. The voice that's asked the questions that make you ashamed of yourself. Or maybe they don't. When it comes down to it, and then I'm going to scroll down and it comes down to, are you really okay with this? Or are you just choking back your fears because you know it's wrong to feel this way? You know, where is the line? The one that tells you what a thug looks like and a respectable black man wears. The one that makes your gut turn when your daughter introduces you to her new boyfriend and a young black man looks you in the eye and shakes your hands. Where is your line? Because being a racist doesn't mean wearing a hood and going out in the street and marching. You know, you have to, as a person and as a culture, we have to confront the fact that, you know, a black man can be our coworker, but he can't be our president. And that's a line that people draw. You might think that you're not a racist because you don't, because you don't burn crosses in people's yards. But man, you have to confront the things in your body. And that's a micro thing that you've been taught to believe and that you don't even necessarily fully understand because that's racism too.
Yeah. And it spans across races. That spans to Latinos. That spans to Asians who have the same thoughts. And it spans to black people who have the same fucking thoughts about Latinos, who have the same thoughts about Asians, have
exactly.
the same thoughts about black people. It's a system, and it is a pathology. And as Eddie Glaub puts it, it's a congenital disease.
What? It's fear. It's fear that, it's fear that the man, if you will, has been putting into us since the 1600s when they pitted poor white people, poor black people against each other so that we wouldn't rise up against rich people. It's about the fear that churches put into us of these cursed people in the South in the 1800s. It's about the fear that people who genuinely do hate put into us that black men were going to marry our daughters and assimilate our culture. It's about the fear that politicians put into people that the free black slaves were going to take the poor white people's jobs and then you'd be out of it's all about the fear that's been preached to you in your life. You don't hate, man. You're afraid. You're afraid of other people taking what's yours. And ultimately, that's what you talked about, that zero-sum game earlier. Man, we have to change the attitude in America that race relations is a zero-sum game and realize that 1 + 1 = 2, that we're not talking about a minus equation here. We're talking about a plus equation, that when we finally are willing to look each other in the eye without fear, that we can be more than the sum of our parts.
Well, and it's funny. Now, I got a DUI 2 years ago. Actually, my anniversary was yesterday. And because of that, I've been recently taking public transportation because I got caught driving with my license under. It's a mess. But, you know, it is so funny to see just the way people act in public when you're riding transportation, because I usually take the train. And I love when we get to Tower City. It's like the biggest train stop in Cleveland where, you know, it's public square, big businesses and things like that. And I love watching all the people get on at public square because from the point that I get on at, it's mostly a black crowd that gets on the train with me because I'm coming from East Cleveland, which is, you know, not the best part of town, but it's very heavy populated with black people because, you know, of course it's a struggle just like everywhere else.
White flight.
Yeah. And
sure.
Mm-hmm. So there will be like, you know, there's two seats to each thing and everyone's getting on the train. The white people will stand at the front of the train and there will be tons of seats open next to the black people. And then if you look around with the people that are sitting side by side, it's white people. And I'm like, what, do you think they're going to rob you? Like, the fear is so real. Like, it's crazy.
It works in the other direction, Molly, too. Man, now I'm going to admit to something that bothers me right here that I don't think I've ever told anybody. You know, I ride the bus occasionally because I live right in the dead center of our city, and sometimes it makes sense. Louisville doesn't have the greatest public transportation system, but it works if you live right dead in the center of the city. And I catch myself once in a while. This is this is a positive thing, sort of. But it indicates an attitude that I had to work on, and I don't do it anymore. But I used to catch myself when I would see a young black man get on the bus with his child. And I would think, oh, wow, isn't that nice? A young black father is spending time with his child. And I'm thinking, whoa, wow, that is a really shitty thing for me to think. You know,
right, right.
That's not so. I shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, I shouldn't be. I shouldn't think that's an awesome thing. It's a thing for you. That's something you're supposed to do. And so I don't think that when white fathers walk on the bus with their children, you know, and those are if you don't confront yourself about those thoughts, man, then you're not doing yourself any favors.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and I
think. You're thinking, and that sounds like a positive thing on the surface. It sounds like I'm happy for that guy, but I shouldn't be happy for him because a black guy spending time with his kid. That's what you're supposed to do.
Absolutely.
I should be happy that a man is spending time with his kid. It doesn't have to do anything to do with him being black. You know, I have a childhood story here, something that really shaped me.
Okay. Before you do, I wanted to just touch on something that you said, as far as like recognizing those individual thoughts or those microaggressions before you even have them. And for me, like, even though I recognize those, when it comes to like misogyny, it's even in person, like I'll glance out the side of my eye to look at a woman. And it's like, why? Like, it's not even, why is that necessary? Like, why? It can't be that part of my day. Like, I really need to cut that shit out. Stop.
You know, when I get on the bus, it's not because I can't afford a car. I own two cars. They're paid for. It might be more convenient for me. I might be going to the arena to see a basketball game and don't want to park my car for $20, you know, with 18,000 other people. You know, I live three blocks from Churchill Downs. If I want to go to the races, man, I'm either going to walk or I'm going to take a bus three blocks, man, because it costs $1 and I don't have to park. You know, but when you see somebody else get on the bus, you think, oh, well, maybe they don't, you know, they're, you know, poor, or they don't have, you know, and no, man, you don't know that right. That person might be just like you.
True.
And, you know, and that's, you know, seeing people as being like yourself instead of seeing them as being different. And which actually kind of relates to my anecdote. I remember, my parents moved into the house that they live in 1982. And there were two black families that lived in our neighborhood. One that lived next door to us, and they're like family. My brothers and I were pallbearers at both of their funerals. The little girl who's my age, her best friend lived a few houses down and across the street. And they moved into their house. The folks next door moved in right before we did, and the folks down the street moved in a little bit afterwards. And they lived on a corner lot with a garage, beautiful house. And their father of the family was a small business owner. He owned a service station. And, when they moved in, it wasn't a few weeks afterwards, somebody, in the dead of night snuck over to their house and right on the corner where the sidewalk went around the corner, spray painted the N word on their sidewalk in plural, as if to say, hey, this is where they live. And, I remember the next morning, you know, when it was a Saturday morning when we discovered it. And of course all the kids, we got out of the house first, you know, mom in those days, it was go out and play with your friends, you know,
right.
And, we walked out there and we went and we were going, you know, me and my little, you know, black girl lives next door, you know, we're hanging out just like we do because we're kids and we don't know that we're supposed to not like each other. you know, we were go out to play. Well, hey, let's go down to Shelly's house and see, you know, if she wants to hang out too. And, we walked out onto the sidewalk and man, I didn't even know what the word meant. I wasn't raised that way. And I mean, really wasn't, you know, and which is kind of, I found out later is kind of odd, you know, but my mom just didn't tolerate it. And, so Kat, I remember the look on Kat's face. She went inside the house and she went and got Shelly's dad and he stood there and he looked at it for a long time and he walked back in the house and he left it there. He didn't cover it up. He didn't clean it up. He didn't do anything. He didn't even really react. He just left it there. And I didn't realize it as my 8-year-old self. But as an adult, I realize now exactly what he did. And eventually, you know, a few days later, somebody else in the neighborhood, I'm assuming a white person because there weren't any other black people, came over and covered it up. They spray painted over it in gray so that it wasn't there anymore. And, the lesson that I got from that as an adult is that the person who did that, and it wasn't just the person who did that, the people who looked at it, who knew who did it and didn't say anything had to be confronted with their shame. They had to be confronted with the fact that these people, these respectable, nice family, just like yours, was being treated poorly. And somebody was ashamed enough of these other people's actions that they came and they covered it up because they didn't want to look at it anymore. And by him not covering that up, he taught an entire neighborhood a lesson in not only tolerance, but proper behavior, you know, in decency. You know, you can't understand how wrong it is until you see it in yourself. And that was, you know, that's something that stuck with me all those years, is that Shelly's dad did not cover that up. He wasn't ashamed of it. He wasn't angry about it. He left it there for people to be ashamed of until they realized how wrong they had done him. And that, man, you know, I probably ought to write about that one of these days.
Yeah, I would.
And, anyone's final thoughts? Because I wish Leslie were here because this was, I think, something she would have really enjoyed, being able to discuss. And I know that, you know, as listeners, the listeners are going to enjoy this, but I just think that it's no secret. And the thing is that I guess for some people, if they admit that their family, who they think are good people, have terrible pasts, that it somehow invalidates them as people. It doesn't. You have to be able to see the duality in people. My grandmother, I use her as an example, for a lot of things because she was, much like my mother, she was sweet, she was gentle to me. My grandmother wasn't so nice to my mom. And I'm putting that lightly. My grandfather, wonderful human being to me. Our relationship is wonderful. However, the interactions that he has with other people are problematic. So you can have, it's not either or. You can have both. If you narrow yourself down to thinking that, you know, these types of things happen on firm black and white lines, you'll never fucking learn anything. You'll never understand or appreciate people for who they are.
Mm-hmm. And you're never ever going to rise above any situation whatsoever until you're willing to acknowledge and admit and, you know, grab it by the horns, whatever the issue is. I mean, anything, a boyfriend, you know, or someone in a relationship cheats on the other one, like progress can be made if a conversation is had and, you know, people admit things. Like, that's how things get better, is acknowledging that shit happened. What can we do to make it better?
I also would like to end up with, by saying, and it's something that I guess is the reality of what makes this all tough. And it's also something that annoys the shit out of me when having conversations with other people, is the first thing they'll be like, well, what are you doing? What are you going to do to make things better? How's this going to change? How's this going to change? Well, let's be real about this situation. Just like I was explaining before, you know, about how the European, as we need to get away from the European, ideal or whatever, but that's exactly what we have, because we are a Eurocentric country. Obviously, you gotta ask the question, and it's the question begs, which goes into what people need to do to make things happen. Does the institution that is white people and white supremacy want to change? I mean, when you think about it, having a subservient is a good way to put it, a subservient group of people, which I would say are the class system, right? The poor, whether you're a minority or not, but are your serfs. And then you have this upper class, upper crust, where in America, they give you the idea that if you work hard and you follow the laws and you do what we tell you to do, you have the ability to get to the upper crust. And that's the part of the American dream that kind of just like blows my mind. Like, do you not understand that we live in like a more diverse form of feudalism? Like, capitalism is feudalism plus the ability for you to change your position. And so, until people realize that, like, the way that the laws are, the way that the you know, criminal justice system is set up, the way that the education system is set up, the way that the job market is set up, the way that the entertainment industry is set up, is for people to, you know, come up. Yeah, sure, if you're good enough, but to fall in line, we're not going to be able to get to the issues of what needs to change, or be able to just evoke the changes that need to be happen and that need to happen, I should say. And that happens in a microcosm. So, you know, I definitely appreciate that, you know, this set in a microcosm and macrocosm, because people lose sight of the micro. They get so wrapped up in how horrible things are on a major scale, you know, Black Lives Matter and Mike Brown and Ferguson and New York and Oakland and you know, all these other places that, you know, have all these big atrocities happening.
Los Angeles.
Yeah, sure. But then people need to pause. People need to pause and use that grief on the macrocosm to work and change things in the microcosm, because that is where you are. And once that happens, all these other systems will soon break down, because then they will realize, oh, well, I guess Black people really aren't that bad, because, you know, they just needed some representation or whatever it is. You know, you gotta do things where you are instead of expecting things to happen on a big scale. 'Cause it's not. The status quo wants it to be this way. They want Black lives to not matter. They want poor to continue to be poor. They want big corporations and businesses to be able to pay for politicians. They want it that way. 'Cause if they didn't, it wouldn't happen.
It wouldn't be that way. That's right.
Molly, did you have any final thoughts?
I just had my little mini one. Just the one I said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of want to close this out, because we've had a really good discussion. And I just want to explain again why we had this discussion, because I want to make it clear for the listeners. Because, you know, when we talk about that Black Lives Matter, we have to be able to understand that we're dealing with a system and a practice of white supremacy that opposes the reality that Black lives do matter. And so in order to understand, or in order to combat that system, in that practice. And to stop that practice, you have to understand what you're dealing with. And I thought that this would be a productive way to gain a better understanding for people. Because honestly, as a black person, before I started self-teaching myself about this stuff, I didn't know shit. Like, I accepted the status quo and I just dealt with it. And it wasn't like, it seemed really fucking unfair and it made me hate myself at times, but I didn't even understand how to combat it. So what was I going to do? Just give up hope. And so when you understand something, you're able to better deal with it.
That's exactly it, man. You know, the last thing I want to say is that the reason that, and I come back to this a lot, the reason that Dr. King, who was an amazing, amazing leader, was so successful was that he understood that the struggle had to be won in the hearts and the minds of the oppressors. That when it becomes no longer tenable, you know, ethically or economically or in you know any other way and especially ethically, that was his thing, to keep people down, you know, when your conscience could no longer bear the actions of you and you see yourself in the community of the people who are committing these things,
right. that you benefit from.
That's exactly right. When, the reason, you know, I'm brain farting here. Earlier in the conversation, we talked about, what are you going to do? You know, what do you do to make it better? You know, every day, I can't deny or even turn down my white privilege. I get it in ways that I don't understand it every day. But, you know, there are ways that I get it that I don't see it every day. Just people who help me out because I'm white male. I'm sure I get job interviews because my name is Tim and not, say, Demetrius. The way that I can help every day is to call other people's attention to the fact that there is a white privilege and there is a problem with our education system and the way we teach people. There is a problem in that we have to face it and to confront people, not necessarily, you know, in a confrontational style, but to confront people with their own feelings about it and to get their conscience into play so that they can no longer morally deny, you know, human beings what they're due. I really think that, you know, if I took any lesson from the things that I've learned about, you know, Dr. King, it's that the conscience is a very strong motivator. And when white people and not just white people, but white people, realize that they don't feel good, you know, that things are going on in their name that they don't feel good about, that's when things are going to start to change.
I do have one tiny thing actually, Ricky.
Sure.
But just that people remember even though they don't feel like maybe something matters that they might have done or said, you know, the butterfly effect is really real. You know, there might be something that you said that someone overheard. You might have done something that someone really appreciated that might be life-changing, and you never in your whole life, you will never know what an impact that you had on that person. But, you know, that it has to start somewhere. And there is no shame with, you know, acknowledging, you know, that you never thought it was wrong to think that a black man with his son getting on the bus, that thought might have not been the right one. You know what I mean? Like just really realizing and just thinking about everything you're doing. Like if everyone would just take one day and really thought about what they were doing, like if you step out of the way, when you see a black person walking towards you, but you'll let a white person graze your shoulder. Just, you know, the tiny little things that really put into perspective, like what the real issues are, because it's so easy to just think about your own self and your own day and not realize that, that collectively it's so much greater than that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And not about, John, not, Molly, do you want to, let everybody know where you guys can be found.
John, where are we?
You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. So, you know, those apps and things such as such. You can check us out on our website, thepennymandoctrine.blogspot.com, podomatic.com if you like going directly to the website, slash the Pennyman Doctrine, that is. You can follow us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/thepennymandoctrine. And you can follow us on Twitter, which is, I'm trying to step my Twitter game up. So, you know, hit me up, y'all. I'm trying to get these likes up, or these follows up. But I'm TPD Podcast.
And I'm Molly of TPD.
And we're on YouTube. We got some YouTube videos that we do whenever we interview people. And if we get some feedback, we want to do feedback shows. And once we get a little bit more comfortable financially and other things, we want to make other little type of videos as well. So subscribe to the YouTube channel. And that's all about the big major stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And Tim, did you want to let everybody know where you can be found?
Yeah, you can find me pretty easily. My real name is on everything that I do, so that you can find me. My name is Tim Druck. You can find me on Twitter as SouthEndTimD. You can always find me at OnyxTruth.com as a column contributor, and you can find me at Onyx Truth Live on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. We go live on the air video, and then you can always download the previous podcast as well. And hopefully you can find me right here at Ferguson Response, because I'd like to be back in the future. I really enjoyed this experience, and I'd like to thank Ricky for having me on here tonight.
No, and I most certainly appreciate all three of you guys joining me. It was, for me, I brought stronger guests on because of the fact that I knew Leslie wasn't going to be here. You know, once
we're making your big sister proud, John.
Yeah, yes. See, and John, no one had to tell you to shut the fuck up.
I know. I was going to say that.
I'm so proud of you, John. I'm so proud of you. I am. You're getting better.
You're a civil human being,
and you're good at it.
I normally am a civil human being.
No, you're not.
It's like 60-40, John. Not really. Right. I wouldn't call it that either way.
I mean, look, it's just certain things that get me going. If you listen to the Onyx Truth Live, you're going to hear me go off and say some stuff. And, sometimes on my show, I build that up and then I let it out. So you're right. I did do a good job.
Every listener of this show should go to last week's Onyx Truth, and right toward the beginning of the show, I asked a question of another guest, and the face that John and Johnny Silvercloud made at the same time was absolutely comical. You guys have got to see that.
Yeah, the last two have been they've been pretty combative.
Oh my gosh.
My guest spot included. That was incredibly interesting. We're actually recording this Friday night, right before, a couple of hours before you guys do the Onyx Truth Live. So, by the time it comes out, there should be another episode. So there may be three straight combative episodes. So, yeah. And I think I look so far, I think the episode that I was on was by and far the most watched one yet.
And I was supposed to be on there. I'm so mad. Oh my gosh.
You didn't want to be there. That was unpleasant.
Oh, I did.
I'm proud of myself for doing it, but honestly, when you deal with someone like, as I've called him, the biracial racist's favorite biracial racist, like, you know, it's frustrating. I almost blew a gasket. And yeah, everybody knows that I'm already passionate as is, so it was, like, I almost got caught throwing double middle fingers up at this guy. And it wasn't even something on purpose. It was like, I was so upset that I just threw them out there and didn't even think. And luckily the camera, like, because it was switching at the time, didn't catch it.
I gotta go back and look for
it's
it now.
Like the, it's at the 2 hour, like 201 mark, I think. It's like, it ends up being 220. But it's like, you can just see my hands float in the air. And it's like, oh shit, thank God they didn't catch that. Oh man.
Yeah. You know, I watched the last 20 minutes today, and oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's amazing.
That's all I can say.
Yeah. All right. That's going to end the segment. You guys take care.
And thanks again to Ricky and our guests, John, Molly, and Tim, for joining us for this really important discussion. We'll be back shortly. Our next episode will be tackling the topic of intersectionality in the Black Lives Matter movement, and we'll be additionally robust. And again, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search for Ferguson Response Network, or you can find us on our website, fergusonresponse.org. And if you have any upcoming actions in your area or are looking to connect with people that are planning actions in your area, just go to fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mac, MAC, and you can find Ricky at AUA.org.